Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to welcome Martin Kirk to the podcast. Martin is co-founder of The Rules, a global collective of activists of all types dedicated to challenging the root causes of global poverty and inequality. He's also a consultant for the Novo Foundation, helping advise their work on supporting communities to transition to new economic models. Prior to The Rules, Martin was the head of campaigns at Oxfam UK and head of global advocacy for Save the Children. So thank you very much, Martin, for taking the time to join me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
You're welcome, Fergal. Thank you for inviting me.
So you've done a number of different things over the last few decades in the world of environment, in the world of environmental change. And can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing at the moment? And specifically, I'd be interested in also getting a sense about what The Rules is about.
Sure. Yes, I've been working on environmental issues of one sort or another for 20 years or so. But my background didn't start, and I didn't come from the environmental movement. I came more from international development. I worked for Save the Children. I worked for Oxfam. And when I first started in those business, climate change was obviously an issue, but it wasn't front and center. And we're only talking, 15, 20 years ago. But it gradually became, the more and more dominant. So I worked for I was a lobbyist with Save the Children. I started doing public campaigning work, looking particularly public campaigning work with Oxfam. And then I started to really look at the narratives that we tell around these great big issues, because it seemed to me I got very frustrated by not being able to understand why, for example, if you look in the UK, where they were doing lots of polling on people's attitudes to poverty, the line of support for action on global poverty always floated around the 25% mark, support for that sort of action. And I couldn't get an answer to why 25%? Why not 15%? Why not 50%? What is it about 25%? And what insights can we gather there? So I started to look at psychology, cognitive framing, started to talk to linguists, started to branch out, in other words, beyond the traditional policy and campaigning areas, and speak to people about these bigger psychological questions, which we term as basically, which are all captured in narrative. So I started to look very much at narrative. And that's when I started to really, my view of the world started to change quite dramatically. I had been very much a mainstream thinker in many respects when I was inside the development sector. And it was only when I started to really look at the psychology, really break down the stories we tell about climate change, about poverty, about inequality, that the rot at the heart of the logic made itself so apparent to me. So just to give you an example of that, when we talk about global poverty, if you take the language used by anybody from any of the big NGOs, pretty much the United Nations system, the World Bank, the IMF, big rich governments, they all basically tell the same core story about poverty, which is that poverty is just something that's natural in the world, that the way we solve it is largely through acts of charity, from rich people giving a little bit of money to poor people. And that kind of just exposed to me just how what deep assumptions that are buried in these stories we tell, that actually if you expose them, you put them on the surface, you look at them, you go, that's just not true. So I started to really lose faith in the core stories that we were telling around these things. And that's when I started to move into working with The Rules. So we set up The Rules in 2012 explicitly to try and shift some of the deep logic in some of these stories that we tell around, particularly poverty, inequality, and climate change. Three things we call separate issues, but are actually deeply, deeply interlinked. And all track back to the same root causes. And so we've spent the last 6 or 7 years trying to figure out ways to do campaigning that gets at those deep logics that don't just operate on the surface, And shift some of the belief systems that we have around these issues. Not facts and figures, not the what we think about poverty, what we think about climate change, but the how. How do we conceive of this problem? Because that conception that we have is made up of all sorts of things, facts and figures, but also our own personal experience, our emotions. It's a very complicated set of things that create our opinions on these issues. And some of those, the component pieces of those belief systems are, as I was saying earlier, just factually incorrect. So we've been trying to work on those, because once, if you can work on the deep belief systems that people have, all the actions and all the policy level opinions they have start to shift. You know, those deep, the deep psychology, the deep belief is like the soil from which all our opinions and actions grow. So I would say like 90, 95% of all campaigning happens at that level of what we think and do, not the deep level of our belief and our worldviews. So we spent the last 7 or 8 years at the Rules trying to figure that out, how to engage at that level of psychology with campaigning technologies. And now I'm just shifting, and I'm going from the global right down to the local, and I'm sure in our conversation we will explore why that is, because that again has been a very fundamental shift in my thinking about what's where we are and therefore what's needed.
Excellent. That's fascinating, and I certainly want to come back to this deep theme of the stories and the underlying logic and the underlying the way we conceive of these questions. But maybe there is also, I guess, as you say, the what's happening, and what is happening that is on your mind. Obviously, the way we tell the stories is important, and unpacking that, and we can talk about that. But in terms of, you know, you mentioned inequality, poverty, climate change, numerous environmental boundaries. What would you highlight as being your biggest concerns that's on your mind at the moment?
Well, there's the obvious answer to these questions, which we don't have to look far for. I mean, we just, you know, the headlines these days, you know, it's a relentless litany of very, very concerning facts and figures, whether it's late, you know, the ice melt in the Arctic, or it's loss of flying insect biomass in Europe, or it's the bleaching of the coral reefs, or it's the amount of plastics in the oceans, or, you know, any of these things. We just keep getting hit with these things day after day. And so we can each get pulled into despair at any one of these headlines. But the individual headlines aren't the things that really keep me awake at night. What keeps me awake at night is when you stand back and you look at the operating system as almost like a sense-making machine, and you assess its health on that ground. Are we, as a collective, as a human species, are we making sense of the world? And I would say my perspective right now is that we are fundamentally not making sense of the world. Our sense-making capabilities have failed us. And this goes right into the depths of our ways of handling knowledge as a society. So if you just take, let's go straight into something like into the climate system, for example, the way we handle knowledge around climate. So the IPCC, in its desire to be acceptable to politicians in the world, has a certain way of operating, which makes sense if you say we have to be exceedingly careful and only ever put out information and opinions that we are confident of, that we can back up, to the satisfaction of essentially climate denying politicians. Then the process that they've set up makes sense. But if you're asking the question, does this accurately represent the reality of the moment, then absolutely it just fails us. So just to give you an example, so the IPCC, the data the IPCC works with is at least 5 years old. The processes by which they will allow material into the IPCC process guarantees that it has to be at least 5 years out of date, because it has to be published, it has to be peer reviewed. And to get from data to peer reviewed publication takes on average 2 years. So even if only we were working on that time scale, everything we hear from the IPCC is at least 2 years old. Then it has to go through the process of the IPCC things getting approved by the ICPCC. And the IPCC doesn't put out things that scientists want to put out. The final level of approval goes through diplomats and politicians. So you can see in the way they process information, it is inherently conservative. I'd say sensible rule of thumb is it's at least 5 years out of date. And that's just the root science of it. And you look at the pace at which the climate system is changing right now, 5 years is an eon. One of the things that you'll notice through all these despairing headlines we get, there's an underlying theme that everything's happening faster than was expected or predicted. So we're in a situation where things are happening far faster than were being predicted. We're already working on information that is at least 5 years old, and it's having to be approved by politicians before it even gets to the public. That is not a recipe for clear sight of the problems that we face. And this is made all the more damning by the fact that the information that we were getting, even if it was being presented to us in its truest form, is phenomenally complex. It is exceedingly difficult to read, and it is exceedingly difficult to predict from. The best we can do is look at trends and expectations of patterns of movement. Nobody can predict with any certainty exactly what's going to happen next in a system of this complexity. So we're shooting ourselves in the foot even before we try to recognize the deep complexities that we're dealing with. So the systems, the knowledge management systems that we're relying on to get us through this most dangerous period are failing us profoundly. So anything we hear coming out of the IPCC, anything we hear coming out of the mainstream bodies has to be taken as exceedingly conservative. So when you get these daily headlines telling us things are much worse than they thought, that's barely covering it.
Yes. And that is a this nonstop messaging is it's often presented in a fragmented way and not joined up. So you see these things happening, and I know certainly in the United States, but even on mainstream media in the UK and so forth, it's much less frequent that they will actually join it all up as a systemic issue, at least at the level of climate change and global warming, maybe a little bit more recently with the heat wave this summer. But there has been an issue. I mean, the stories we tell, the stories we talk about, that and the environmental movement has had some criticism about negative stories, relentless negative stories, many of which haven't panned out. I'm just wondering, can you talk? I mean, we jumped a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but when you mentioned that, I was interested to just see what is your sense of the impact of these ongoing news bulletins, as it were, from the front line, not the IPCC, but the reports that are coming out the whole time. The various bits of information that we're getting in different ways, and when you put it together, it is terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, let me just check you on one point there. Actually, most of the major predictions and expectations and the trends that have been mapped out have been pretty accurate.
Yes.
They have panned out. Now, of course, you can find this one micro prediction that didn't turn out exactly the way it is, but you look at any of the major trend predictions from the modeling, they have largely been on track.
I wasn't referring specifically to the climate change, but I mean, I guess the limits to growth and some of the Malthusian ideas are, you know, around that, they have been used a bit as a beating stick and saying,
limits to growth, business as usual prediction scenario is pretty much spot on. The Malthusian stuff, that's a different thing. I'll separate that out. But limits to growth has been actually exceedingly prescient in its...
And I suppose that I get it. You get a sense that people are, one way or another, a bit overwhelmed with stories of doom and gloom.
Okay, so And I think we've misdiagnosed the problem here. That's absolutely true. And a few years ago, I was working quite a lot ago with a friend and colleague of mine called Tom Crompton, who'd done a lot of work looking at that. What happens when you trigger fight or flight thinking in people, and what happens when you get people to think about death, for example? And you're absolutely right that there is the way that we have presented the scenarios. There is an easy criticism that it's been too doom and gloom, and humans don't particularly respond well to doom and gloom. However, I think the problem there is not the doom and gloom. It's what you were pointing to earlier there. It's our ability to see the whole. And that comes back down to narratives. And actually, our root, almost like the system condition that is, this isn't, you'll hear the irony here, the system condition we're dealing with that is most problematic is that humans have not been trained how to think systemically. We do not see the connections between things. We see things individually. This is how we've been trained. This is the Enlightenment way of thinking. This is the basically based on the metaphor that the world is a machine that can be taken apart into its individual components and then built back up again, and that we know that's not true. The world is a living system where everything is deeply interconnected, and so our modes of thought mitigate against us being able to see things clearly. Now there's a contrast to that sort of thing. So if you take, for example, I'm not sure if you saw a couple of years ago, Paris, I don't know if anybody was paying attention, they would have seen some First Nations protesters or protectors from I think it was from, they were North American mostly, but they were starting to tell a very different type of story. So if people remember, there were banners saying things like, "We are not protecting nature, we are nature fighting back." Or the idea from Standing Rock that we are not protesters, we are protectors. These little shifts in the language are actually signaling something very, very deep. They are coming from a very, very different type of worldview that does see things in an integrated way. So let me give you an example of the sort of language they use. So I live in Colorado, and not too long ago, last year, down in the southwest of Colorado, there was some protests against some coal. Coal mining, and these were indigenous protests, and they referred to coal as the liver of the earth. Coal is the liver of the earth. Immediately you think that, you're into a systemic form of thinking. Because if you describe something as the liver of the earth, that you're using a bodily metaphor. You're saying the coal is like the liver of a body. Now, instinctively, without a moment's thought, we all know what happens if you take the liver out of a body. Yes. The body dies. Yes. Because everything is connected. So there's you can just see in that one use of a metaphor, it's like a doorway into a whole other way of thinking about these things. So, and it gets you, there's a whole language out there that does this inherently without having to kind of take people through each step. If we dig up the coal produces carbon dioxide, the carbon dioxide warms the atmosphere. Da, 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 da. Now you're into having to logically explain one fact after another, which is a super inefficient way of communicating. But if we could harness this more systemic language, you can start to understand, you can see how we could get to a more accurate understanding of the way things work. I mean, at this point in the game, it's of course you want to try that, but you know we're exceedingly short of time, and these things do take time. So I'm not saying that's a solution to our crises by any measure. But if you're trying to answer the question, how have we ended up in this situation where we are so disconnected from reality, and attempts to talk about it just get this pushback of stop being doom and gloomy? It's actually, I think, our answers and our understanding of how we got here lies in this sort of question, rather than just saying, well, you can't be doom and gloomy. You have to provide hope. No, you have to represent the world in an accurate, true way first.
Yes. And that's it's very interesting, because when you start to look at systemic dimensions, I mean, where does any system begin and end? But you can't really get away from the global economic system.
and, you know, carbon emissions. And what they call the neoliberal turn, or the last 30 years of economics and the way the global economy has unfolded. And again, underlying that, there is this question of stories. And this story has been told very effectively. And it didn't emerge, seemingly, just like that. But there was a very clear effort by particular thinkers, by particular think tanks, to construct a set of ideas. And they have proven very seductive. And it seems that today, that whatever we call the version of the neoliberal story does seem to be up for grabs. There does seem to be, it seems to be increasingly threadbare. And there does seem to be possibly an opportunity for new stories to emerge.
Definitely. And actually, for the first time in the last 12 months, I've had a sense that it's emerging now. And I can see the outlines of it in a way that I couldn't do even 10 years ago, certainly. And I'm talking about the work of people that you've interviewed here before, like Kate Raworth, like Project Drawdown people. You've got people like Jason Hickel and different economists telling a different story of how, and anthropologists, how we got here. So I'm really sensing that a new economic logic and contained in a new economic narrative is emergent. Whether it can emerge in time to effectively bring kind of a fundamentally change the what we're looking at, I don't know. But yes, in that sense, things are looking more hopeful than they have done, certainly for a long time.
And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, there seems to be some momentum, at least, and corporations have been a dominant part of the our world for, over a century, and, have obviously been very effective in certain respects in wealth creation and building, large organizations that work, albeit around a pretty narrow set of objectives, or single objective. There does seem to be some momentum with the B Corps now and around that, and also in terms of finance. And I'm just wondering, how much of this has surfaced, do you think? Is this on your radar? Is this something that you look at? And one cannot get away from the weight of money and finance, and the deregulated finance we've seen in the last decades. And I just spoke to Carlotta Perez recently, and she has quite strong views on the role of the state and regulation, but particularly with respect to footloose capital in creating change and going forward. I'm just wondering to what extent those different areas are on your radar.
Oh, they're massively on my radar, and actually, they they are the reason, really, what I'm doing, making another very profound shift in my approach to this, and going very local, because if you look, let's take the airline industry for example. The airline industry, you have within it, it is a big contradictory mass of things. You have within it people like Richard Branson, who are trying to push the envelope on airline fuels, for example. And that gets headlines and it sounds great. And yes, let's all reduce the impact of airline fuels. However, when you look at the entirety of the intentions being held within the airline industry, they want to double the number of flights by 2034. The airline industry has never been more profitable. Their growth projections are immense. You look at China is building 200 new airports right now. A 10% reduction in fuel efficiency is nothing next to that. So if you're looking at that aggregate level, you have to accept that this machine is not stopping. This machine that requires endless growth, that requires endless productivity increases. The energy contained within this machine is unstoppable at a certain level right now. And so the only thing And which isn't to say that all the arguments shouldn't be made at that conceptual level about how the whole system needs to change. But to my mind right now, the most important thing that can happen is to build write the DNA of the new model at a micro level so that it can infuse and grow within the body almost of the old system. So like a caterpillar, and this is a much overused metaphor, but it is actually very true. It's actually very handy actually for this. You know, when a butterfly, when a caterpillar goes into its chrysalis, it breaks down completely, or it goes into goo and then it is rebuilt. Now, what we're actually doing, the liminal cells that are created in the chrysalis that create the body of the emergent butterfly, that's what we need to build. We need to build within the casing of the old, the DNA of the new. And doing so in full knowledge, this is a race against time. There's no guarantee this is going to work. But we damn well know that communities from north to south in the coming years are going to need to be an awful lot more resilient to shock, whether that's financial shock, ecological shock, health shocks. You know, these shocks are just, we're just at the beginning of this period of disruption. So building resilience into communities is an absolutely essential function. As you do that, you can build in new economic logics. It's a difficult choice to make to start to focus down on that because it feels its own type of incommensurate. Like how, you know, I can work on this one town or this one village or this one city, but I'm still looking out at it and I'm looking out at a whole world system. It's deeply frustrating. But it's only when that's why you have to have that deep realization of the fact that the system at a global level has a momentum to it that we are woefully dismissive of. I mean, if you think about the IPCC's report 2 months ago, where it said we have 12 years to dramatically reduce carbon emissions. And that was presented as if that was a credible choice, as if seriously there is a set of decisions that could be made this year, next year, that could achieve that. It's physically impossible to achieve what the IPCC is saying needs to be achieved in the time required, and yet we treat it as if it's a legitimate goal. So we have to get over this. We have to get over this idea that some of these simple solutions, if the right people make just the right decisions in just the right ways, we can avoid the worst of what's going to come. And I give all credit to the IPCC. That was very brave of them to write that report and make those statements, because it required them to be politically brave because they were going to get an awful lot of flack for it. Although interestingly, we're seeing that people didn't respond with quite the level of dismissiveness that they have in the past. There wasn't that outrage that you're being doomsday about everything that there would have been even 5 years ago. So that does signal to us that the environment is hearing, is starting to acknowledge the scale of the threat. The problem is even that acknowledgement is 20 years too late. So at some level, there just has to be a recognition. We can have all the nice, quaint debates about whether it's humans respond well or badly to difficult information, but there is a basic truth here that there is a level of information that just has to be grappled with. Now, it doesn't have to be grappled with by everybody that you meet in your day, but it does have to be grappled with by people who are fundamentally trying to really engage this. And not sugarcoat it. When you do that, you're left in a situation of what is the best route of harm minimization, making sure that the least amount of suffering happens to the least number of people over the course of the next 50 or so years. You are left with the inescapable conclusion that we have to start in every community. Every community has work to do to make itself more resilient. And the connection between those and hope and work towards the idea that in connecting enough of those communities and enough of that work together, the new logic will emerge in a way that gives us a better rather than the worst chance of weathering the next period.
Well, that's profound. That's deep. And I think it was Hugo Bardi who said that collapse is a feature, not a bug.
Yes.
And I think that's quite a interesting way of looking at things. And but as you say, not uncontroversial and not without its challenges and not without a lot of heart and mind to really get to grips with this and making decisions of that nature. I'm wondering, this is the sustainability agenda. We're talking about stories, way we frame questions. And I'm just wondering, what does sustainability mean? Is it a useful way of framing what we need to do at the moment? You talk about regeneration. There's a lot of resilience. People talking about regeneration. I know the whole question of sustainable development has come under question as an oxymoron. And I'm just wondering to what extent you see the resilience as being a really important way of framing ways of dealing with the problems we have at the moment and also in light of whether there are other ideas.
Yes. You mentioned the two that I think are the most, can I say, honest, really, which is resilience and regeneration. And regeneration is such a powerful concept, and it is so much better than sustainability. At the most basic level, if you strip away all the sound and fury, this system is not sustainable by its nature. And so the idea that we can make this way of being sustainable is itself a lie. It's not true. It's just factually incorrect. We cannot. And the reason I say that, let me be clear about why I say that, because this system is designed to express the logic of growth. Growth isn't a bit on the side. Growth is the prime directive of this system. And by growth, we mean a very particular type of growth. We mean growth in the supply of capital. This entire global system follows one overriding rule, which is make more capital. And it makes capital by turning other things into it. Sometimes capital, you know, capital, as a friend of mine says, you know, the miracle of compound interest is really just capital making love to capital. So that it generates itself, but the other two ways it does it, it turns natural resources and human resources into capital. And that's the purpose of this system. It really, you know, the clue really is in the name. It is capitalism. It's about capital, increasing the supply of capital. Now, that is on a finite planet, when you have a finite amount of materials and you want to grow them infinitely, there's obviously just a deep lie, a deep disconnect there. So that very logic is what has to change. But unfortunately, that logic is written into the DNA of most organizations, most businesses, most people. Most people, like, don't we all expect to grow our salary as we go through our careers? Don't we all expect to get bigger houses? Don't we all expect that growth mentality in our own lives? And so this is the level at which our problems lie. And there is precious little imagination around to articulate how things needn't be this way, how growth isn't a law of nature, how capital growth of this sort isn't a law of nature. Growth, of course, is life happening. But we know in our own bodies we can separate good growth from bad growth. I only have to put the word A in front of it, and suddenly I know exactly what's good growth and what is A growth. A growth is bad. We have no problem understanding that. And yet we do not apply that same logic to the economy.
We've talked about this question of growth, and what we have certainly seen is the growth of these giant organizations. Technology companies, global corporations. I mean, the multinationals have been around for a while, but the way in which they straddle the planet and the power that they have across borders, the sheer economic weight they have, and I guess in various countries too, particularly in the United States, the way in which the capital has actually hollowed out many aspects of key functioning elements of the democratic process. So there is this sense of massivity. I'm just wondering, we're talking about the pace of change, the need to change fast. On the one hand, some people will say, well, these big organizations, they've clearly got to be part of the solution. And, you know, when they move, things happen. So Walmart initiates a circular economy initiative, or Dell or something like that. These are great things. And many small organizations around the world will feed into that. And yet, at the same time, these are huge. These are organizations which, you know, are beyond our.
That's absolutely, that goes to the crux of so many issues. And this is something that we don't talk about enough, I don't think, this question of scale. Now, what we're really talking about here is feedback loops, because feedback loops keep entities together. So for I don't know if people remember this, but way back when the first Scottish referendum was being done, there was some really interesting work done by the, I think it was the SNP did it at the time, but they used some research on the optimal size of government to population it manages or governs. And what they were looking for was, at what level of scale does the feedback loop start to break down between population and government? And this, the indication that they came to was, it's around 3 to 5 million is the optimal size, where the population are still actually sovereign to the government, that the feedback loops, the government has to stay responsive to a high degree to the population. Now, if you think about it, even the UK is, what, 65 million? The US is 360 million. China is 1.2 billion. We are, and then you layer on top all the corporations. What you're looking at is entities that really have very, very little connection to the effects they generate on the ground. So if you think of like a CEO in a big corporation, there is no credible way they can understand the impact of their decisions on the people that are affected by them. They are just too big. If you look at Unilever supply chains, for example, and how many thousands of people are influenced along the way in a Unilever supply chain. And then you think of the decisions that are made in head office and how they ripple on down on through. And then you attach the environmental impact to it. By the time all the information feeds its way back into the head office at Unilever, it is so conceptual, it is so divorced from lived experience, that essentially it is all done in theory. They never have to actually face the consequences of their decisions. It all comes back as conceptual information. They don't have to stare the people they're affecting in the face. They don't have to stand in the dry riverbed, which gives you that whole bodily experience of reality. And this super conceptualization of life is one of the things that leads us into these dead ends that we found ourselves, because it becomes almost all conceptual. And actually, we are no longer actually connected to the world around us in any meaningful sense. So this is what scale does to us. When we operate at too high a scale, we operate at too high a conceptual level. So in one respect, you can think of the challenge of the next period is to reconnect with these feedback loops. And again, that has to happen from the locality up, from the bottom up. You can't impose a feedback loop in that sense from the top down. Feedback loops are a question of scale. So building those feedback loops back in, so that communities are connected to the businesses that serve them, is a way of rewriting the code of the system. I was reading a fantastic book this week by a woman called Marjorie Kelly, and there was this one line in that just really kind of crystallized a lot of this in a little insight, which might be helpful. She wrote that ownership, and bear with me here, ownership is the original system condition. So ownership is the thing that generates who owns what, sits at the very, very heart of the system. And right now, we have ownership in a very, very concentrated form. So this is what we mean when inequality is basically a representation of ownership. So right now, fewer and fewer people own more and more of things, which means their influence is greater and greater and greater. That's another way of pointing towards bad feedback loops, inappropriate feedback loops. So this question of scale is something we have to get to. And unfortunately, the only way we can get to that is like I was saying earlier, is to build in different feedback loops and different levels of scale from the ground up. And that's a time-consuming thing to do. The good news is that there is an awful lot of this happening already, far more than the mainstream media would ever give you the idea. So if you just take, for example, there are so many different good initiatives going. Let's just take one called the Fab Cities initiative, which is something that came out of MIT. And it's basically the idea is taking fabrication, consumption and production, and relocalizing it. It's using digital fabrication, like 3D printers and that sort of thing. But also, it's not just you can get caught with the shiny 3D printing, but it's also basic technologies like saw cutters and sheet metal machines. The sorter, and they've come up with five machines that you need to basically maintain an industrial way of life. But the way they operate is not big global supply chains. With 3D printing and local production capacities, we can have all the production local that uses local feedstock materials with designs that can happen globally. With digital communication structure, means I can share my design with somebody in Barcelona, the drop of a hat, and they can make exactly the same thing that I designed in my house in Colorado. They can make it in Barcelona with their 3D printer. I don't need to buy the materials, put them together, ship them over there. They can get materials from their locality. So that sort of initiative is happening, and it's happening in big cities and small cities. It's a little hive of activity that barely gets any mention in the mainstream press. You've got things like the New System Project here in the States, and they're working with people like Preston in the UK and the Mondragon in Mondragon in Spain, which is a hub of cooperative worker-owned cooperatives. You scratch beneath the surface, there's an enormous amount of this sort of activity going on. The question is, can it happen in time? And is it actually all coherent with itself? And right now, I don't think it is. I think you've got things like the Fab Cities who are solving for some of the issue, some of the big supply chain issues, but actually not solving for the DNA of growth. Whereas you have something like the transition towns who are getting to solving for the DNA of growth, but aren't capturing the potential of the digital communication infrastructure necessarily. So you're seeing all these disparate little things popping up, and you can see, if you stand back and you look at all of them, you can see the emergent thing, and it is going to coalesce. And if there's time and the right sort of focus and support and incentive, something else is here. It's coming.
That's very optimistic. That's an optimistic note from you, from you, Martin, in our conversation. Can I just introduce the question of power, the question of vested interests, yes, the question of status quo, and related issues of how that these elements can come together and stop they stand in the path. To what degree do they stand in the path of this new future?
They absolutely do, and you're absolutely right. And power is the fundamental question. And I think that actually is dealt with also in that statement I just said about ownership. Ownership is the original system condition. More ownership is more power. So distribute ownership, you distribute power, is a very, very simple way of describing it. So what we're talking about here is different ownership structures. So I just mentioned Mondragon in Spain. Last week, I visited Cleveland in Ohio here, where I was looking at this Evergreen Co-op initiative that they've got, and very innovative. And they've had to struggle with the IRS to allow them to do this, but they've done very interesting. And this is just one example, for example. So they've got a series of worker co-ops where the workers own the business, and it's an industrial laundry and a hydroponic greenhouse and an renewable energy company. And over the top of it, providing governance for it, is a 501c3 or not-for-profit, mission-driven entity. So that provides its governance guardrails. So for example, if the laundry, for example, wanted to leave Cleveland and grow into a big multinational laundry, it would have to get the permission of the not-for-profit governance structure, which wouldn't allow it, because the governance is defined as providing benefit and ecological sustainability to the community. So that provides you with a model that you can see. You can have good business, you can have successful businesses, you can have workers distributing the profits, which is a distributed power model, essentially. which can generate a new different type of politics in a locality. And now you can scale it up and it can become an emergent phenomenon if it happens in enough places and they're connected through. This is how you work with power, by working with ownership.
That's very interesting. And you, as you mentioned, we talked about capitalism and its unchanging, its relentless ability to keep reforming in one way or another and keep going. And, you know, there has been significant changes in the structures of corporations, maybe not in important ways with respect to, you know, the profits and shareholders and concentration of power and so forth. But they are in some ways they've been very flexible in creating and, you know, this kind of globalized world. What about government? And we talked a little bit about it. You talk about power. We see this farrago we see it in the United States, but we see it here in the UK with Brexit, and it's just so distressing. And it's clear that the government is not working. You talked about the kind of scale of governance that works best. How do you see that unfolding and that changing? How does government become more fit for purpose, as it were?
You know, this is where I get a little defeatist. And actually, I was reminded, people have been watching this young Greta Thunberg recently from Sweden. Gosh, she's been coming out with some of the best lines. In COP last week, she said that wonderful line. She said, "We're not here begging you for change. We're here to tell you change is coming." And that's kind of where I'm at now with the governments. which is not to say that every possible effort shouldn't be made. You know, we really are in all of the above strategy required right now. We need to keep the lobbying pressure up. We need to do everything to move them in direction. But we should not be thinking they can save us. We should not be outsourcing responsibility to governments at this point. They are largely bad actors on the stage. And we have to try to keep making them better actors, but not relying on them as the solution. As Greta said last week, you know, they haven't even been able to speak the truth to us about the situation. Even that burden, I think, was a quote. Even that burden you leave to your children. That hits.
Yes. Yes.
And I think it's absolutely true.
Yes. Now, that was a low note, as it were. You say that it ran out a little bit of optimism on that front. We touched on some of these points, and where are you optimistic? I mean, I'm tying that into what's next for you. You mentioned moving on into a more local kind of environmental initiative or local initiative generally. What are you up to, Martin?
I'm going to be moving work shortly from working with the rules, which was exclusively looking at that global narrative space. And I'm going to be taking up a position helping the Novo Foundation work with a particular city in upstate New York to try and make it into a kind of a model of the new system at work. So we're working on the electricity grids. We're developing an organic farm. We're looking at cooperative structures, supporting cooperative structures to emerge as a much stronger base to the local economy in the city. Looking at supporting local currencies. So we're taking a lot, and we're looking around all the ideas, like the Fab Cities I was speaking about earlier, and the Next System project, and all these other initiatives that are around there. We're trying to take the best of all the things we can see in each of those and make them relevant for this particular city of Kingston, upstate New York. So that's going to be my work for the next, well, probably a fairly long term. But to actually get into literally building, writing the new code into the system, and building the new system in one place.
That's a great vision, Martin. And I wish you the very best of success with it. And thank you so much for sharing your research, your ideas, and your inspiration with the Sustainability Agenda today.
Thank you so much, Virgil. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.